Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. We're glad you're here. Glad we're coming to your ears. Hey, I just wrote that.
Nice. It was very bouncy.
Yeah, well, I'm feeling bouncy.
I like that.
I feel bouncy. It's bounce. 8:30 at night. I just had some coffee for some stupid reason. But well, we were going to record, so I wanted to...
That's true. You're going to pick it up.
Be ready, and I will deal with those consequences tomorrow. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
So good to have you.
Always.
Yes.
Always. I'm Diana.
I'm Eli. We are excited to have you. We're excited to tell this story. Got to do a little housekeeping here first because, man, we are backed up.
I know, right?
On our machine here, and we have yet, it's been a minute since we have checked our answering machine.
Just answer the question.
So back in our Rachel and Jackie Robinson episode, we asked you guys what in the world lettering in sports was.
Or any subject, because we
didn't realize you could.
Well,
lettering.
I lettered in drama,
right? You
but
lettered
I
in
still
drama.
Don't know what the hell it means.
Right, exactly. And what, how do you, I don't know, like, what does it mean? Because I didn't go to a school with any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So fortunately, y'all rose to this occasion. And gave us many answers that were awesome. So at Lady Teague on Twitter, she told us that she remembered that she lettered in band while she was listening to that episode. Kind of like Eli was like, oh yeah, you know what? I had lettered in something.
Yeah.
She reminded us about Tammy Curry in Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Of course. Of course.
Right? So she sent us a gif of like Tammy showing off all the patches for all the things she's lettered in.
Uh-huh.
And it was the school initials on the front and then individual sports and club patches down the arm of the jacket. So that's a letter jacket.
Oh, Drop Dead Gorgeous is so good.
Well, I hate to say it, but I've actually never seen Drop Dead Gorgeous. So
okay.
That's why maybe perhaps I didn't know about that.
We are going to stop recording right now and go watch Drop Dead Gorgeous because what are you talking about?
I don't know. It's one I never
that
got.
Was
I
like,
know people have talked about it, have told me about it many times over
I don't
years,
understand.
But we just never got around to it. For
I swore that was like in our vows, something about how like, and I'm so glad that you've also seen Drop Dead Gorgeous. It's so funny. Smize and Shine on Twitter also let us know that if you letter more than once, you get the letter first, yeah, and then a pin or a patch to put on that letter for every additional year you letter. I do remember getting bars to pin onto my letter for drama.
Okay.
Smize lettered in field hockey and got a pair of crossed field hockey sticks, and for track and field, got a track cleat.
Oh.
See, that's cool. We got
a boring-ass,
like, silver bar.
Yeah, they get some cute-ass
no,
like, pins.
Drama masks or anything like that, which, honestly, like, I'm so sick of the drama masks being representative of the entirety of theater. I'm like, it's been 600 years.
So much
can we come up with something else, y'all?
It. And Linda on Instagram lettered an orchestra. She
awesome.
Played violin, so her pin was like a music staff and harp.
Beautiful.
I know. And she also told us that there are different styles of letters to denote varsity and junior varsity, which, okay, that was a whole other level. I was like, what? Now
it
this?
It just keeps going.
So anyway.
A whole culture here with these letters.
A lot going on with these letters that I had no idea. But these pins sound cute as hell. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, again, I probably still have those boring-ass little silver bars around here somewhere.
It's too bad you didn't get a cool-looking something.
I don't know. Y'all, now you have to write in and tell us what'd be a cool idea besides
the
drama
the
masks.
Drama masks, yeah.
To represent theater.
You get like a ruff, like an Elizabethan ruff for Shakespeare.
Eh.
No?
It's the same thing. It's just a dated, just like this archaic image. Like, give me something fresh and poppy and modern. I want to know what represents theater now. How come whenever we talk about theater, the first thing anybody thinks about is 1,300 years ago? You know? Look, I'm just saying.
Just all the avant-garde stuff is flashing in my mind. I'm like, you can't let her in. Andy Warhol's weird pig thing show that he put on.
Let's hear it. Well, thank you guys for educating us on letters. And
that.
I hope that if you didn't know these things and you're a regular listener, that you've now learned as well.
Yeah. Yeah, another great answering machine. Thanks, guys.
Yes.
Appreciate that. It's nice to learn so much from you while we're here to impart knowledge.
Yeah.
You know?
And one day, one of our listeners is going to be on Jeopardy, and there's going to be an answer comes up about lettering, and they're going to have it. They're going to be like, yeah, remember, they Alice said in Ridiculous it was cute Romance. Flair. And then I hope one of your categories is strange relationships throughout history. And Drew Carey is, wait, who's hosting Jeopardy now? Drew Carey? That's
oh my
not
God,
right.
Drew Carey.
That's Price is Right.
That's not
right. Whoever they got. Mayim Bialik. Temporarily and whatever. I hope that's not my Jeopardy answer.
I know. That would like, so this person's
this
hosting
person hosts
Jeopardy.
Jeopardy. Who
is
Drew
Carey?
Look, we're not here to talk about Drew Carey today.
No. We are here to talk about Marguerite Allibert.
Ooh, we are returning to France?
Oh, yeah, oui, oui, oui.
Truly the epicenter of ridiculous romances.
I know, right? But anyway, Marguerite Allibert was beautiful. She was charming, daring, sensuous, avaricious. Mm. Everything you need to be a successful, high-class Parisian courtesan.
Ooh.
In the turn of the century. I guess I should, now I have to say in the turn of the 20th century.
Yes.
I forgot I have to say that now.
Right. We've had we've had another century turn since then.
God damn.
Whoops.
And she had some of the wealthiest, most highborn clients from several countries, including the Prince of Wales.
Uh-oh.
But it was the impossibly wealthy Egyptian Ali Fahmy who would capture her heart. Or at least her hand in marriage. She probably expected to divorce him quickly and get a sweet settlement. But Ali had other ideas, and soon her only way out was murder. How would she keep her neck out of the gallows? Let's find out.
Let's do it.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all. An abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
Marguerite was born to a cab driver and a housekeeper in 1890, so humble,
yeah,
humble beginnings.
Modest, working class.
At some point in her childhood, tragedy struck when her four-year-old brother was struck and killed by a delivery lorry as he was playing in the street.
It's awful.
And Marguerite was blamed because she was supposed to be watching him. And so he had run off and they were like, you should have been more careful.
That's more awful.
So then they send her to a convent for her education. And the nuns, like, were reminding her daily that her brother had died because of her sins.
Jeez,
and, like, they
nuns?
Were pretty abusive. Yeah, it was like one of those hit you at the stick.
Yeah, rulers
spots.
Across the knuckles.
Ouch! Totally. But Marguerite's got a pretty strong character, so she kind of was rolling her eyes about it as well. She was a little bit like, okay.
If you say so.
Sure, sure, sure. But she was also where she was, and this is very indicative of her character, too. She wanted to get as much out of any situation she was in as she could. So she did that here. She applied herself to get her a good, pretty good basic education.
Yeah.
And she also learned to sing.
Oh,
very chanteuse.
There you go. Now, when she was in her teens, the nuns decided to place her in the home of a wealthy lawyer, Henri Jules Langlois. So I guess it was like, you know, you're old enough to get the hell out of here for a while. You'll continue your studies, but you're going to hang out with this family, learn a little something about the real world, and
well,
start to get out there some.
Get some work done.
Get some work done.
Get a job.
Right.
More than likely.
Get your hands dirty. Mm-hmm. It's not all knuckle wraps and choir practice out there in the real world. In Andrew Rose's book, The Woman Before Wallace, he says that in the 1880s, Langlois was the lawyer for the infamous Humbert case, or Humbert case, a giant scandal. This rocked Paris. In that case, Thérèse and her husband, Frederick, the Humberts, they basically invented a rich American benefactor and persuaded people to loan them money at low interest rates.
Mm.
And total fraud, of course, which
I'm guessing
netted them.
They didn't pay that money back.
Yeah. You know, I've got it around here somewhere. I will give you a call later as soon as I find it.
I left all my francs in my other Reading goods.
This fraud netted them 100 million francs at the time, which is close to 400 million euro today.
Yee.
Rose writes, quote, although discovery and retribution were inevitable consequences of so colossal a deception, a valuable lesson was almost certainly not lost on Marguerite. The fraudsters had succeeded in duping the public because they aimed high, brazenly keeping up their act until the very end. The luxuriously appointed mansion that was the Humbert's Paris home for 20 years was just a few steps from the cramped and modest apartment shared by Marguerite's family.
So, yeah, so she's basically steps away from this fancy-ass house that they got by lying. So
yeah.
She's just looking at it every day like, I could do that.
Mm.
I can lie.
Mm. Scam your way into a huge fortune, eh?
And the Langlois family was very rich and very cultured. And so Marguerite was closely studying how the rich lived their life, how they talked, you know, what they wore. She was kind of starting to get her mimic on a little bit about the airs of society, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But her time there was fairly short. She abruptly left the Langlois home in 1907 when she was 16 because she was pregnant and unwed.
Zut alors!
Oh, sacré bleu!
Quel dommage!
Etc.
Yeah.
And the paternity of her daughter, Raymond, is unknown. Marguerite invented a couple stories over the years. In one, the father was a 28-year-old friend of hers who really wanted to marry her, but she just didn't have a big enough dowry. So she wrote, quote, the beautiful dream collapsed.
Yeah.
Sure.
He lives in Canada? And I swear he was going to marry me, but he just, what a jerk. I was not wealthy enough for him.
How rude. In another story, the father was the younger son of a diplomat in India, and he perished in the Great War. She also wrote one time that her younger brother also died in the Great War, and it was a family friend. It was like, no, he was 4, died in the street. She
wow.
got blamed for all that. So she's kind of a big liar.
Well,
she doesn't really tell
you know,
the truth.
If you had to come up with a story about someone's death
yeah.
in the early 20th century, the Great War is a great excuse.
Oh, man, sure.
Maybe the Humberts were like, oh, I had all your money, but it died in the Great War.
That's
so sorry.
But more than likely, it was probably just another servant in the household or possibly a member of the Langlois family impregnated her.
Oh.
But no rich family wants some pregnant, unwed teenager hanging out, making them look like a house of ill repute.
Right.
So Marguerite was kicked out of the house and she returned to her family home for a while, but they were kind of too poor to provide for her and her baby and
right.
two additional mouths. So her daughter Raymond was sent to the country to like live on a farm for a few years with some people who could handle it, while Marguerite plotted her next move.
Marguerite knew that she was meant for bigger and better things than some, you know, working class life.
Mm.
And she was willing to do pretty much anything to get it. Thanks to her time with the Langlois family, she already had a sheen of sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to her time with the nuns, she had a bit of an education. So for a year or so, she lived in obscurity in Paris. She glossed over this time in her autobiography. Researchers speculate probably because she was making her money through street prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she was singing in bars and cabarets and just going home with the richest guy she could find at the end of the night. And
right.
she
make
sort
it
of
ends
like,
meet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make it ends meet. You
hey,
know
there
saying?
You go. So she's making it work, but maybe later, by the time she's writing her autobiography, she's feeling like maybe that's beneath her.
Right, right.
So one day she came to the notice of Madame Denard, who ran a type of high-class brothel called a maison de rendezvous.
Ooh.
A house of meetups.
Ooh la la.
Madame Denard wasn't in this business to make some buck off a quick tumble.
Mm-mm.
Her girls were the best in Paris, you know? Come on down to Madame Denard's. We got the smart girls. We got the pretty girls. They're witty. They're charming. They're intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
They got CD players. They got drop-top roofs.
Beautiful beyond compare. Look at these curves.
And no money down. Well, actually, all the money down up front.
Exactly.
And Bad credit? Get the hell out of here.
No credit? Get the hell out of here.
So Madame Dinard had a very discerning eye. She knew how to pick the best, and she was only going to pick the best. She knew Marguerite would attract men like flies to honey.
Ooh.
Rose writes, quote, although not a chocolate box beauty, whatever that means.
What is a chocolate box beauty? I kind of wish I was one.
You just wish you had a chocolate box.
I do wish I had a chocolate box. That would be so beautiful.
You are a beauty. But you don't have a chocolate box right now. And if you did, I would eat all of it. So I'm glad you don't.
Oh, all right.
So although not a chocolate box beauty, she was petite with a shapely figure, expressive greenish-gray eyes, a pretty mole on her left cheek, and a large, sensuous mouth.
Blah, blah, blah.
At this time, she wore her striking auburn hair in long tresses falling to her knees.
Ooh, well, she sounds like a hot tamale.
Healthy description. Well, it's France, so she'd be hot...
croissant.
She sounds like a real hot croissant, a hot galette. That is one hot quiche.
Oh.
So not only all this beauty and allure, but the nuns had helped Marguerite become a decent mezzo-soprano. Mm-hmm. So she even had a skill that could be displayed on stage, a common place for courtesans to catch the eye of potential clients.
Right. Like
she'd
we
get
mentioned,
up there, sing been... like a canary, right. Give out a little tune, and they're like, I'll take that one, please.
She caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like Evelyn Nesbit on stage in the Chorus Line, catching attention, you know, and meeting patrons, you know. It's exactly the same thing.
So this girl was worth a little investment for Madame Dinard.
Mm-hmm.
Some fancy dresses, a few elocution and piano lessons later, and they had exactly who they needed.
Ooh.
Marguerite would become, according to Madame Dinard, quote, the mistress of nearly all of my best clients, gentlemen of wealth and position in France, England, America, and other countries. It was me that made a sort of lady of her.
Ooh.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup. C'est moi. Oh, you like Marguerite? Well, you know, that's all me. Yes.
I love your French madam. I think you should really think about
go to France
character.
And open a brothel. Oh, a character. Yeah,
I was thinking more like a character, but
because I will go to France and open a brothel if you feel like there's a good business model there. I think we could totally pack up our lives and do that. We'll keep doing the podcast.
Sure. So yeah, almost immediately, Marguerite attracted her first wealthy patron. A married businessman named André Meller. And she started calling herself Maggie Meller and Madame Meller, even though they were not married. And because he's already married.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go out together in high society, which was totally acceptable in Paris. People started to notice her, started to meet her, and her social circles got wider and wider. Marguerite was on her way to the top. And we are on our way to a commercial break. How about that?
And welcome back to the show.
Oh, and here's something we thought was cool. Andrew Rose also says that it's likely Maggie closely followed the case of Marguerite Steinheil, who you may remember from our episodes about her. And the French president, Félix Faure.
Oh, a classic episode.
Oh, yeah.
Wherein...
we had to do it in two parts because in one part, the first part was when he died, when she gave him a blowjob and she had to sneak out the hotel.
Yep.
The second part was when she got accused of shooting her husband and mother and was put on trial for murder.
Right.
And that was in 1908. So this was when Maggie was out and about in high society. It was certainly rocking society, as talked about.
Everybody was paying attention to that.
Everybody
surely
was looking
Maggie
at that.
Was looking close.
Absolutely. And yeah, she was on trial for killing her husband and her mother. And her testimony was like, listen to our episode all about it because we get real deep into it.
Cuckoo.
But it was like all over the place. And she definitely made some shit up and was caught in a million lies. Just whatever. Just acting foolish. But even so, she was acquitted. She walked free for those murders.
Yeah.
And they can never really prove that it was her. Andrew Rose said that that probably showed Marguerite Allibert as well as everybody else, quote, that a beautiful woman could murder her husband, tell a preposterous story, walk free from court, and collect an inheritance.
So something she might have just filed away in the back of her mind.
Right, just in case it comes up.
Right, right.
It's always good to have a nice full toolbox at your disposal.
You never know when that's going to come up. So mixing and mingling with the elite of Paris brought Marguerite even more attention, and she was flirtatious.
You know it.
So André, who was, you know, her main guy, who was paying her bills, basically. Yeah. He traveled a lot. So while he was gone, she continued her work as a high-class courtesan and was very successful. Mm-hmm. She and André would be together for around 7 years. And this would be marked with lots of fights because André was jealous and Maggie was, you know, fiery. And she even called herself, quote, a terrible she-devil because of her own temper. Madame Denart wrote once about an occasion where Marguerite slapped the shit out of a wealthy admirer in full view of an entire restaurant. So Maggie, you know, she's ready to throw down.
Yeah, she will. You will catch her hands.
Yes. Finally, in 1913, she and André had a huge fight that really became something of a scandal. She locked André out of their expensive villa and released all of his horses from the stables to wander the grounds freely.
Oh, no.
So
he was like, sacre bleu!
Mes chevaux! Gossip columns were having a total field day with this.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Hot French side piece saddles up by releasing her lover's horses all over his pasture.
She was his main girl.
Oh.
Now
greener
she
pastures?
Is... Now she is trotting away to greener pastures. So André and Maggie agreed that, you know what, it's probably best if we part ways now.
Everyone's laughing at us.
Uh-huh. She was given a severance package, essentially. 200,000 francs. Mm. And in American dollars today, that would be like getting $5.5 million.
What?
What? Somebody break up with me for $5.5 million, you know?
Oof.
Marguerite was later actually furious at herself for accepting such a, quote, paltry sum. She chalked it up to her youth and inexperience. I should have known better than to walk away with $5.5 million. Stupid Marguerite, you can do better. So stupid.
What are you all tit and no wit? So, yeah, so now Marguerite is on her own. She's got her own little money now or whatever. So she installed herself in a fancy apartment, few servants. She had a stable full of horses, couple limousines. I mean, she is ballin'.
Yeah, all right.
And thanks to her time with André, she cut quite a swath through fashionable Paris. She knew a lot of people, tons of good connections. And she had her finances in order, so she did bring her daughter to come live with her back from the farm.
Phew.
So Raymond is back.
I was wondering about that girl.
But in 1914, of course, everything changed because of a little something called the Great War.
We always introduce the Great War like a little spat between Germany and the rest of Europe.
That's true. And Marguerite was seized by an impulse to serve the war effort. You know, she had some patriotic music in her head or something playing, and fortunately, she had just bought herself like a fancy car.
Mm-hmm.
So she used it to chauffeur officers and other like high level officials to hospitals you know, offices and stuff. Get it?
Yeah.
You know, just like transport.
Yeah.
Very important.
Please don't bleed on the seats. And off we go.
This is a new car.
Buckle up.
But Marguerite, you know, she's no altruist, and so she got bored with being like this goodwill, patriotic bitch for real quick. She was tired of that fast.
Yeah.
And conveniently, her doctor diagnosed her with a mysterious ailment that required a warm climate to recover from.
Oh.
How fortunate. So she took herself off to Cairo, where she became friends with a wealthy businessman. She met some high society British and Egyptian men and was just kind of living it up in Egypt.
Sounds fun.
Right, I would do it. But by 1915, she was back in Paris And she and Madame Dinar parted ways pretty acrimoniously.
Oh, no.
Madame Dinar does not write very fondly of her because of however they parted, whatever was said.
Yeah.
But Maggie started working for a new madame who ran the most expensive maison de rendezvous in the entire city of Paris.
Ooh la la.
Kind of a step up for her.
Andrew Rose describes how it worked back then. The maison was a beautifully appointed, fancy apartment. Clients would be greeted by a respectable maid who would serve them refreshments in a lushly decorated lounge. Photo books were set out so you could peruse the ladies at leisure and make your selection. So you're literally swiping right or left.
Right, on a bunch
ladies.
Of pornographic, like, yeah. Nudie photos.
Uh-huh. The biggest, most prominent photos were the top tier, most expensive ladies of the bunch. And this is where you'd find Marguerite's photo. So you're getting like a full page spread in the photo album,
mm-hmm,
or like
mm-hmm.
little wallet sizes in the back. They were the cheaper girls.
Right. And they would be like, one day my picture
uh-huh.
will be 8.5 by 11.
Well, you better learn to sing. Marguerite was a high dollar not only because of her beauty and her social graces, but also because she was one of several women who were, quote, equally happy to play the dominatrix, wielding a horse whip, to take part in lesbian activities staged to the customer's requirements, or even to indulge in a client's taste for sodomy.
Oh my.
So she had a lot of items on the menu,
yeah.
basically,
right.
which made her quite valuable. Once you made your selection, you and the madame would chat and decide on a price, and the madame would telephone the woman of your choice. So, and if she's not here in 30 minutes, your sex is free.
Probably like your sex is double for
yeah,
the
right.
transportation.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Most of these assignations happen between 5 and 7 p.m.
Would you call that a happy ending hour?
Oh. in fact, Marguerite and women like her were sometimes referred to as une dame à 5 heures or a 5 o'clock lady.
Oh, I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Now, it is a good time to be a high-class prostitute because it's wartime and that means officers.
Oh, deep pockets.
Hey, hey, hey. I mean, and they've, you know, been on the front. You know, they're on leave.
Yeah.
They're ready for a warm embrace.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, business was booming and Marguerite was out and about with more and more of the upper echelon. And then in 1917, she landed her biggest fish, Edward, the Prince of Wales.
Wow, that is a big fish.
A big old fish. And that brings us to this episode's side piece.
I won't tell anyone, I promise.
So you may know of Edward pretty much from his most infamous action, which was abdicating the throne in order to marry the American divorcee, Wallis Simpson.
Ah, yes.
Really upended the whole royal family.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about it a little bit.
We touched base with them during Winston Churchill and Clementine, yeah.
But that would not be the first time that Edward caused trouble for the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
He was a little bit of a naughty boy.
Yeah.
by the time he was hanging out with Marguerite, you know, he's still early in his career. He's still young. He's like in his 20s. And he had witnessed trench warfare firsthand. He definitely was like, put me in coach, you know. And they were
yeah.
like, no, you're the freaking heir to the throne. And it,
yeah.
like, what if they caught you? You know, that would be so crazy.
Oof.
You can't be out there. But he was, he was pretty brave. He wanted to be out there and fight the fight. He was one of the most photographed people in the world at this time. Because he is super, you know, friggin' famous. And his rank and good looks gained him a lot of attention. But his womanizing and his numerous affairs with married women over the years caused a lot of embarrassment for the crown.
Oh, yeah. Well, that sounds like the worst thing about him.
Well, he also thought white people were superior.
Whoops.
And often expressed incredibly racist views. And later in his life, he did tour Nazi Germany and expressed pro-Nazi sympathies and was kind of like, maybe they got the right idea over there in Nazi Germany.
Yes, boo, children, boo.
So, you know, that hadn't happened yet, but that's the person that we're talking about.
Yes. So racist stuff notwithstanding, because that is, you know, arguably the worst thing about him,
mm-hmm.
of many things. But the real problem that the crown was having with Edward was that he was very indiscreet.
Yeah.
He drew a little too much attention to embarrassing things that he did.
Yeah.
And he wrote them down.
Yeah.
Was a big problem. Like, dear diary, today I truly embarrassed the family with the following incriminating evidence.
Here are several witnesses to my actions. You may ask them and they will verify any of these details.
Yes, I gave them signed copies of this diary as well. One of the things that he got himself in trouble for and writing a lot of stuff down about was his time with Marguerite Alibert. They were together for about 18 months, and a royal Brit can do a lot of damage in 18
Ooh,
months.
Yeah.
And this was until the late summer of 1918. Edward wrote her about 20 letters, according to Royalty Magazine. Quote, the letters not only revealed his feelings for mon bébé, but also included information about the progress of the war effort and made derogatory comments about his father.
Ooh.
So, a lot of bad shit in these letters.
Right. They're like, listen, again, if an enemy were to read this,
yeah.
you're just handing them all kinds of ammo right now.
Yeah.
Plus, you're talking about all this weird sex stuff you're doing with this, like, Parisian courtesan. But fortunately, I guess, in 1918, Edward started to shift his attention to a married woman named Frieda Dudley Ward.
Ah.
And so that was kind of ending his fling with Marguerite. She was on her way out, and she could smell it. But she knew how valuable those letters were. And of course, she wanted to benefit financially from this connection that she'd made with the future king. So she tried to blackmail Edward with these letters.
Uh-oh.
There's no evidence that still exists of what she asked for specifically or anything like that. But in a letter, Edward wrote, quote, I'm afraid she's the £100,000 or nothing type, though I must say I'm disappointed and didn't think she'd turn nasty. Of course, the whole trouble is my letters, and she's not burnt one.
Well, I specifically asked you to burn these letters. I told you these letters could be used as blackmail against me. Please burn them.
Quite disappointed that you didn't do what I said.
I can't believe you hung on to them. Outrageous. And then I also love that he's writing in a letter more incriminating evidence about how he wrote letters with incriminating evidence.
God, they were probably reading it like, God damn it, Edward.
Oh, my God. But Marguerite was also starting a new fling around this time with the wealthy Charles Laurent. Mm. And he was ready to marry her.
Hello.
A new thing for Marguerite.
Cuffin season.
Yeah, that kind of security and stability doesn't come to many courtesans. Like high class or otherwise.
Right.
So she backed off Edward. She thought her blackmail might actually backfire into like a scandal and ruin her chances with Charles.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, all right, maybe I'll just kind of leave this one be for now.
Mm-hmm. Bird in hand.
Yes. Bird in hand.
Worth prince in bush.
Is worth a prince in my bush. So she and Charles did marry, but they were not well suited for each other. He was a very serious guy who didn't like the high society, fashionable party life that Marguerite not only loved, but had made, you know, pretty much her lifetime ambition.
Right.
So their marriage dissolved in 1920. And like she do, she relieved him of a sizable chunk of change on her way out. So, yeah. Like, and I will take that with me. Thank you for the marriage. Good day, sir. So at this point, she is totally independent. She could take care of herself for a while. But she's still in her prime. Mm-hmm. She's only 30 years old. So she kept those peepers peeled for another fabulously wealthy man that she could attach herself to and see what she could get out of him.
Mm-hmm. And enter Ali Kamel Fahmy Bey. People in Paris called him a prince, but he actually was not a prince. Bey is a title denoting an aristocrat or like maybe a governor. So they sort of took that and ran with it and just called him prince because they didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he did not disillusion them rigorously or anything like that.
He's like, yeah, prince, that sounds good.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the French accidentally called me a prince. I'm not going to correct them.
Okay, yeah. Just like, when someone asks if you're a god, you,
you say yes.
He was actually the son of like an aristocratic engineer. His father had amassed this huge fortune over the years, but he was super clutch-fisted about it. He was like a miser, and he refused to indulge in like comforts and luxuries. He was like, I want to take it with me somehow. But when Ali was 18, he got his hands on his inheritance and basically went buck wild.
Right.
Within 4 years, he had spent over £1 million Egyptian pounds. Rawi magazine writes that he, quote, was known to pay tips between £5 and £20 when he frequented bars. This was in the 1920s. Mm. So that'd be like throwing around $60 tips today.
Wow, okay.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
So that might speak to like a generous spirit, but I think he just wasn't very good with money. Because he also paid 13,000 Egyptian pounds for a piece of land in the posh Zamalek district. So it's like a wealthy area and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the land was only worth 4,000 pounds.
Oops.
His personal secretary pocketed the difference. And he just never knew. Like, he's like, whatever.
He's not keeping a close eye
on
these
the books.
Numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. He don't look at the books.
Yeah.
And then he had a villa built on that property that he spent 100,000 Egyptian pounds on. But it could have been done for a fifth of that price.
Wow.
So he's just like...
He just doesn't know.
Doesn't know.
He's just like, what's a gallon of milk cost?
You know? Yes.
Does not have that answer.
No. Rawi magazine goes on to say, quote, one story goes that when he asked for the young, highborn Manira Sarhank's hand in marriage, he walked into her family's house, followed by 20 uniformed men, each carrying a sterling silver box laden with jewelry. That engagement did not last very long, however, as Ali was soon caught engaging in a lewd act with one of the actresses from the Rouhani theater troupe in his car.
Ooh.
The nuptials were, of course, promptly canceled. In case you were curious, Manira returned all the jewelry.
Look, to be fair, the actresses at the Rouhani theater troupe.
Now, let's talk about them.
Hard to ignore, if I may say so myself.
But yeah, we're just, you know, I don't know. Manira returned the jewelry. Marguerite would have kept all that.
Oh, yeah.
All that shit.
Marguerite would have gotten more. Ali is also described as being, quote, nervous and rather weak, but still really used to getting his own way in everything. If he wanted something, he expected to get it, as is the mentality of many extremely wealthy people.
Right.
And he intended to keep it for as long as he liked, and he did not care what that cost. Mm. And now, he wanted Marguerite Alibert. He was formally introduced to her in 1922, but he'd actually seen her a few times before, both in Cairo and in Paris. He was entranced by this beautiful French woman, 8 years his senior.
Ow.
For her part, Marguerite liked his big old fancy house and his cars and his motorboats and, you know, the fortunes that he was able to squander at gambling. Oh, you have so much money. I love that you're so careless with it that you'll lose, you know,
right?
Thousands of dollars.
Well, apparently his annual income was around $2 million pounds a year.
Uh-huh.
Maybe she really was like, literally, he can afford to lose so much money and
right.
It doesn't even matter.
So the two of them embarked on a passionate love affair / spending spree all over France until Ali returned to Egypt. But not long after, he told her he couldn't live without her and he asked her to marry him. His family was not into this match at all. They're like, I'm sorry, you're going to marry this French whore? We are aristocratic Egyptians. That's not how we do things.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know, Ali doesn't like to hear no very much.
I mean, I guess unless the question is, have I spent all my money yet?
Then, no? Great.
Oh, great.
I'd love to hear no in that
situation. I'd like to spend more. Let's go do it.
So obviously, this gave her a lot to think about. Ali was Muslim. And Marguerite would have to convert to Islam if she wanted to marry him.
Mm-hmm.
He also wanted her to dress modestly and cover her face like the other women in Egypt. But Marguerite thought that she was going to be up to all these tricks. She could maneuver and handle this thing in the traditional Marguerite d'Alibert way. She figured if things didn't work out, they would just simply divorce, and she could walk away with a huge chunk of cash. So she insisted on a prenuptial agreement that she would be allowed to wear Western clothing, and also that she would be permitted to ask for a divorce, mm-hmm. which was, of course, not something that was allowed.
Right. The wife doesn't get to ask for a divorce from the husband. That's crazy.
Right.
Then they'd all be doing it. However, according to historycollection.com, Ali ripped up their prenuptial agreement only a couple days before their wedding. And by that time, she'd already converted to Islam and moved to Egypt. So now she had no proof that they had agreed to these terms of hers.
She didn't Xerox that shit.
Right. Y'all need to get copies, okay? Mm-hmm. She should have learned from Edward.
Right.
So yeah, so she was forced to dress and act like Ali had said. He expected women to do exactly what he told them to do without any argument. But, I mean, if you've been listening, you know that ain't Marguerite.
Right.
Okay. And instead of realizing that maybe he pinned down a wasp rather than a butterfly, Ali, true to his nature, doubled down.
Oh, no.
And he's like, I'll tame this shrew. You know what I mean?
This is unmovable object, unstoppable force.
Exactly. Very true. That's very true. He actually wrote in a letter to Marguerite's sister, quote, just now I am engaged in training her. Yesterday, to begin with, I did not come in to lunch or to dinner, and I also left her at the theater. With women, one must act with energy and be severe. No bad habits.
Wow. I love that his punishment is, well, I'm not coming to lunch or dinner.
I wonder if Marguerite was like, oh, cool, that worked really well to get rid of him. I should do that some more.
Right, yeah.
Royalty Magazine says the letter was probably intended to be humorous on, like, some level.
Mm.
So keep that in mind, all right? It's not like he
I mean, cool joke.
But not a great
very
joke.
Funny, yeah.
Very locker room talk or whatever.
I guess, yeah.
But it, quote, reveals some of the tensions in Ali's mind. He clearly felt a need to control his willful wife. So it kind of shows they were definitely clashing on a lot of things
yeah.
at this point. He also announced that he would be taking on multiple wives, as is allowed in Islam. But Marguerite didn't really know shit about Islamic culture or customs or Egypt. Or like, she was
right.
not really prepared for this marriage at all. And she didn't like that idea. To top it all off, his favorite way to make love to her was, quote, par la derrière.
Whoops.
Which was certainly in her repertoire of services, as we remember from
right.
those pornographic
yeah.
books.
Uh-huh.
But they were maybe not necessarily her preference
no,
all
she used
the
to,
time.
She used to charge extra for that shit.
I know. She's like, mm.
That's like on the menu as an add-on. Right.
Right.
Not all the girls do that. You got to pay for it.
Exactly. And right now I got to freaking be respectful and obey you instead. Like,
ugh.
No thanks.
So with all these vast chasms separating them, it's kind of no wonder that they were very soon at each other's throats.
Mm-hmm.
These two fought constantly, often in public, so everyone was aware that they weren't happy together. Ali must have especially hated that if he's like, you're not even supposed to talk back to me.
Right.
And here we are, like, having a public argument. That must have really true. Shaken his principles, you know?
That's very true.
Marguerite would actually make notes daily in her diary of the things she hated about him. Dear diary, today it's that stupid smug smile.
Dear diary, today it is the special noise that he makes when he chews his meat.
Dear diary, today it's that he doesn't treat me as an equal human being. And I fucking hate that.
Dear diary, today it's par la derrière once again.
One day, Marguerite convinced Ali to take a little trip to London to see an opera called The Merry Widow. Like, warning, red flag, red flag, red flag. They took in the play. They had a late supper in their hotel room before starting some vigorous arguing,
uh-huh.
as they loved to do. They were yelling, you know, probably throwing things, like one of those fights.
Yeah, one of those knockdown, drag out
mm-hmm.
type.
We imagine the whole hotel was just burying their heads, you know, under their pillows, trying to get some damn sleep. But
knocking on the walls.
Yeah. Shut up in there. But it was not to be for those poor would-be sleepers. At 2:30 in the morning, multiple gunshots were heard, and Marguerite was discovered in the hallway holding a smoking gun in her hand, standing over her husband's body. He had been shot in the back 3 times. And Marguerite said, "I lost my head. I've shot him." I feel like she shot him in the back. She must have said, "Now you take it, par la derrière."
Oh, no. So, yeah, she's found in the hallway, standing over his body. She's got the gun in her hand, and she fully confesses to killing him. And it could be argued that it was obviously premeditated and that she had enticed him to come to London because she knew that in Egypt she would be put to death on the spot for killing a nobleman.
Oh, okay.
But in England, she might be able to pull some of her high society strings.
Right.
That is History Collection's speculation station.
Okay.
But still, it would probably have been brought up by a lawyer at some point. You know, all that evidence stacked against her, Marguerite is going to jail, right?
I mean, she's literally found standing over her dead husband's body with a smoking gun in her hand. Like, did we find the smoking gun?
Wait.
Quite literally.
But no, not so much.
What?
Not so much. So let's find out what happened after these messages. Welcome back to the show, everyone.
Marguerite was caught red-handed. As we said, smoking gun in her hand. But she wasn't going to face many consequences. Partly this is because of good old-fashioned Western racism.
Coming to save a white woman yet again.
Racism. Saving white people from crimes they committed since 0000. Her case, of course, went to trial, and it was sensational, with people waiting in line at all hours to get a seat in the courtroom. Though he was already dead, Ali was basically put on trial, too, because Marguerite's defense was that he was this savage beast of a husband with perverted sexual proclivities. She was trapped in an unloving marriage with a, quote, these are her words, Oriental brute.
Yes. That's not a word we use anymore, but it is definitely a huge part of this particular part of the story. So
yeah,
we did keep it intact for historical reasons.
Particular brand of racism.
Yes.
Her theatrical performance in court sold papers for days. She told them about the veils and the modest clothes she was forced to wear. She recounted times when she and Ali fought. Witnesses recalled how they'd seen him hit her in public sometimes, much to the disapproval of his family and friends. She even told them he demanded lewd sex of acts, quote, of a sadistic nature.
Oh.
And that she was forced to comply under threat.
I mean, no wonder people lining up to see this case. She's ready to tell you everything.
And it's not to say that these things didn't happen and that he wasn't a big piece of shit and a terrible husband.
Sure.
But her sort of reframing it in this, like, savageness is like she's literally playing into people's racist presumptions.
Yeah, prejudices, exactly. Yeah. And what made it way worse than just her playing on, you know, anyone present and their own unconscious or conscious bias, very conscious bias, was that reporters, naturally, were taking what she said about Ali and generalized it to be about every man from Egypt or the Middle East or any other place over there that's not here, basically. Yeah. As Rawi magazine says, quote, the newspapers, in their frenzy to report, complacently stereotyped all Oriental men as barbarians, sweepingly accused of sharing the victim's sadism and brutality. And it got so bad that Egyptian writers and intellectuals, both male and female, protested so much that several major British publications were forced to apologize for all the things that they had said. Like, that's how galling it was getting around this time.
Yeah. And Marguerite's past as a sex worker was never even disclosed to the jury. They thought of her as a high-born lady who had been horribly deceived by her husband.
Mm-hmm.
They declared that she had shot him in self-defense after being driven to the brink of her sanity by his violence. And Marguerite walked out of that courtroom a free woman.
Ugh.
I mean, not that her sex work, you know, made her more likely to be guilty, but that it was a huge part of the story leading up to this. So to not disclose that really did, like...
Well, and it made him look even worse that he was, like, you know, doing all these lewd sex acts on what who they probably were picturing to be this, like, not a virgin because she's been married before.
Right.
But just this highborn aristocratic lady who doesn't do that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, instead of a woman who had been selling it out of a book for several years at this point.
Right.
So it is definitely, I think it helped her case. Certainly.
Oh, yeah. But it might not only be due to all these horrible stereotypes and racist prejudice. Marguerite may also have remembered those handy-dandy letters to Mon Bébé from the future King of England, Edward, the Prince of Wales.
Oh, shoot! So yeah, at this point in 1923, Edward's many sexual activities had to be hushed up because he was like the poster boy for the British monarchy. And honestly, they needed one because, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution happened in Russia, and that made everybody in aristocratic circles incredibly nervous, as any revolution will.
Right.
And so they were kind of all, in any country, they were all kind of going, how's my working class doing? Y'all doing okay down here? Let me bring in some bagels on Fridays. Casual Friday, you know.
We love the working people.
Yes.
Where would we be without you? Y'all keep working now.
Mm-hmm.
Pay no attention to that man behind the Iron Curtain.
Well, there you go. And then, you know, Edward had some boyish good looks, right? So, and he had done like a tour of some less wealthy nations in the Commonwealth. So he was playing really Prince of the People at this time.
Right,
like he had some real sympathies. And so they really needed to protect this image that they had going of Edward. And Marguerite knew it. These letters could not have come at a worse time.
Mm-hmm.
Express, which is a magazine in the UK, says that only hours after Ali Fahmy's death, advisors at York House, which is the Prince of Wales' official residence, quote, went into meltdown.
Whoops.
The prince was scheduled to go on a summer tour, including several official visits to Wales. But by the next day, all of that had been canceled. A ticket on the next ocean liner out of Liverpool was booked, and his valet was packing for a 3-month stay in Canada.
Whoa.
Like, they were like, nope. Let's
go to a different
part of the world. Yeah, shred it. Marguerite, meanwhile, was entertaining several, like, high-level visitors in her cell at Holloway Prison.
Oh.
So she would just be like, come and see me. Mm-hmm. Like all her rich clients would come by and probably bring her a little treat.
And they're trying to play it off. It's like, oh, I love going to visit courtesans in prison. There's nothing special here. Standard visit.
So yeah, she's got a bunch of high-level visitors and fancy guests and stuff, including, quote, an army major with close but not too obvious links to the royal household.
Now, Andrew Rose lays out this case that Marguerite used her letters to blackmail the crown with scandal if they didn't get her acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
In exchange for the incriminating letters, they took care of things behind the scenes.
Right.
It's a compelling case, and it has pretty thoroughly convinced quite a lot of people, but we've got to say that it's not confirmed fact yet. Although, if we're waiting for the British government to admit it, I think, don't hold your breath.
Yeah, they're probably never going to.
No, it would take Harry and Meghan coming out, like, spilling the beans.
Like, we're ready to tell you all the secrets.
But whether it was the royal machine or the racism machine, or a little of both, let's say, probably.
Could be both.
Either way, Maggie got her wish. Now she had to turn her attention to the little matter of her inheritance.
Oh, yeah, the money.
Mm-hmm. See, she was always expected to get something out of her marriage to Ali besides, you know, a murder charge.
Right. She's like, I'm supposed to be charging you.
Right. So she sued Ali's family to get her hands on his property. But the Egyptian courts were not even pretending to have it. Are you kidding me?
Sorry, girl. Especially after all that shit they were reading in y'all's newspapers about their son.
Trash talk our entire culture. Yeah.
Yeah, no, ma'am.
Yeah. They're like, you're a murderer. You killed him. We don't care what your racist courts say about how he put it in your butt or whatever. You get nothing.
It's like Willy Wonka. You get nothing.
Good day. Now, she overplayed her hand a little at this point, to be fair. Rawi Magazine says that she invented a little story that she had gotten pregnant and had a legitimate heir to Fahmy's fortune and, quote, soon became the laughingstock of Parisian society, presumably because she wasn't able to produce a child to prove this story.
Right?
I mean,
that's kind of a big lie to be like, I had a baby, and everyone immediately goes, where's the baby?
Yeah.
And you're like, whoops, I didn't think of that. Like,
it's not a long con because you don't have long to convince everyone
right.
before they realize you're full of shit and not full of baby. Or, you know, maybe because she kept telling everyone that he always liked to put it in her butt. So they're like, well, then
right.
how'd you get pregnant?
I'm like, so let me know some more information about how you get pregnant up the butt. So, yeah, she kind of faded from public view after all this rigmarole.
Mm-hmm.
And she continued to call herself Princess Marguerite, even though, like we say, Fahmy was never a prince, you know,
right.
but no one in Europe knew the difference. So she was like, cool, I'm a princess. When people call you a god, you say yes.
And you keep that.
And she lived in an apartment facing the Ritz in Paris for the rest of her life.
Not bad.
Spending her time with her daughter and her grandchildren until she died in 1971. Now, at this point, you might remember that she had to hand over all these letters from Prince Edward.
Right.
You know, earlier when they got her off from that murder charge.
Uh-huh.
But Marguerite, you know, she's too smart for that. She had kept a few as insurance. And so she had a few still in her possession, and a family friend finally quietly destroyed them. And all of that incriminating evidence against Edward was finally gone.
Yeah, right.
I know, right?
They're out there somewhere. It sounds like something Carmen Sandiego would steal.
True.
The incriminating letters between Marguerite d'Alibert and Prince Edward of Wales.
History collection says, quote, after her death, her grandson was going through her paperwork and saw that Marguerite had managed to quietly get married and divorced another 5 times without her family knowing about it.
Well, when you're good at something,
you know,
you stick with it.
Never work a day in your life.
Yeah. You love what you do.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Yeah, and Edward's secrets were kept safe for nearly a century until Andrew Rose's book came out in 2013, and he, like, pieced all this together.
Andrew Rose, friend of the British royal family. Doubtful.
Right, I don't think they like him.
Oh, man. Wow, crazy.
So that's the story of Marguerite d'Alibert and her side piece, Edward, the Prince of Wales.
Uh-huh.
And her definitely she murdered him husband, Ali Fahmy.
I know, this one's not even, like, up in the air, like, at least Marguerite Steinheil were like, we kind of think maybe she didn't kill them, you know.
There was a whole necklace thing to think about. But no, this was...
This is cut and dry.
Cut and dry.
Smoking gun.
Yeah. She...
Murder solved.
Killed him.
Free to go.
So crazy.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
This is another kooky one out of... France and England.
I kind of was enjoying it because there's nobody really to feel sorry for. I mean, I guess I kind of feel sorry for Marguerite a little bit because she was kind of entrapped in this marriage. That must have been scary to suddenly be in another culture totally that you don't understand. You're like, oh shit, I really got in over my head on this one.
Right.
And he was kind of, you know, abusive.
Right.
But she also, like, just put herself in so many of those types of situations. And I'm like, I mean, all right, you're fine.
Well, as we learn many times on this show, you know, people have many different qualities and some of them are detestable.
Right.
And some of them are worth sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you weigh them all against each other. And if your soul is heavier than a feather or something, I'm not up on my Egyptian ology either. Well, I'm so excited to bring you all this story. As always, another kooky one full of murder and betrayal and bad toxic marriages.
Right. But yeah, let us know what you think. We
Absolutely.
Always love to hear from you, of course, our beloved audience.
Of course. Please shoot us an email. You can get us at romance@iheartmedia.com.
Right. Or we're on social media, Twitter and Instagram. I'm @DynamiteBoom.
And I'm @OhGreatIt'sEli.
And the show is @RidicRomance.
And we hope that we hear from you. Apple Podcasts, you can leave us a review and some stars. We love that.
We're also on YouTube, so you can subscribe to our channel there, which is also Riddick Romance.
Yep. And we will be back on Friday with another Ricryptulous Romance for our Halloween series of terrifying tales. And we can't wait to bring you another story then.
Cannot wait to see you next time. Love you. Bye.
So long, friends. It's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.